Welcome to Dogs of War Podcast. With your hosts, Sway Houston and Stephen Animarchi.
What's up, everybody? This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Joint Forces Canine Group. Their ad will follow. Also, I'm going to talk real quickly about some big events, seminars that are up and coming with Joint Forces Canine. And so I'll just start with the Practical Dog Training Workshop. It's April 26th through the 28th. And that's going to be with Forrest Mickey of Learburg fame and Dr. Stuart Hilliard of the DOD breeding program out of Lackland Air Force Base there. Also, October 4th to the 6th, Tyler Muto, Optimizing Your Training. And then March 1st through March 2nd of 2025, Larry Crone will be doing another seminar as well. So also, please stay tuned for their ad. It will follow shortly. Podcast is also brought to you by Pocket Suite. Pocket Suite is an all-in-one app that was specifically designed for dog trainers, small to large. I have personally used it for years. It does everything from scheduling to deposits to you can send contracts, you can send forms, you can send packages, you can do online lessons, you can tie it in with all your calendars, you could do online booking, you could it's anything and everything you can think of. You can do it, and then if you reach out to them, they add and they make updates all the time, so it's ever-evolving. I cannot recommend it enough. At the end of the year, they send you a 1099 so you can do your taxes. It's just an amazing app, an amazing group of people built for dog trainers. So check out the unique referral code that will be in the show notes, but it will save you $50 off an annual subscription to Pocket Suite. Do not miss out and check it out. I wouldn't be plugging them if I didn't believe in it. So, alrighty, guys. This episode, I sit down with the police canine handler out of East Tennessee, Derek Bowles. Derek's been a law enforcement officer for, maybe 8 to 10 years, I think. Can't really remember off the top of my head, but he's got a really, really nice canine named Storm, and he actually, at the time of the recording, I had already cast my vote for him to be the number one in the competition seminar down at On Point Canine in Kentucky, but I couldn't tell him. So, but we'll just jump right in, man. We talk law enforcement and dogs. So give it up for the great and powerful Derek Bowles.
From basic to advanced training, Joint Forces Canine offers Arkansas's best dog training services. Whether you want to get your pet up to speed on basic obedience or are looking for more advanced training such as specific odor detection, personal protection, competition and trial prep, service dog training, and more, the professionals at Joint Forces Canine will help your dog become the best that it can be. Joint Forces Canine is veteran-owned and offers all levels of training for pets and working dogs on their 20-acre dog training facility, which includes kennels, an indoor training arena, a pro shop, technical ponds, a trial field, and an agility course. Contact us today for more information and a free evaluation. You can also learn about our boarding, grooming, and working dog sales. Joint Forces Canine, www.jointforcescanine.com or call 479-802-0775. Jointforcescanine.com, 479-802-0775.
What's up, man?
Not much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's weird, like, as soon as we hit record, you can feel a shift where it goes into, like, oh, we're in interview mode instead of conversational. So we'll try and keep it conversational. But, why don't you introduce yourself, tell everybody who you are, what you do, and we'll start there.
Sure. So my name is Derek Bowles. I'm a police officer at not a great big police department, but maybe a mid-size police department in southern Middle Tennessee. I've been in law enforcement the last 10 years, the last five of which have been handling dogs.
Hell yeah. Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in a small town of Manchester, which is, if you look at the map, I-24 in Tennessee.
Bonnaroo.
Yeah, a lot of folks know Bonnaroo. We're essentially the exact midpoint between Nashville and Chattanooga, right off I-24.
Gotcha. Did you play any sports growing up?
I did my entire life. From the time I was four, played T-ball. Played baseball, football most of my life, got into high school, of course, continued to play football and baseball, but I also got into wrestling. I ran track, So I was a four sport athlete going nonstop all year round. And then played a little bit of junior college baseball at Motlow College in Tullahoma.
Oh, no shit. I didn't know that. Yeah. So when did the kind of the law enforcement thing come into your mind as something that you might want to pursue?
So I was 19, 20 years of age, going to school at Motlow, kind of struggling to balance, you know, playing baseball, which in college is a full-time job. At the junior college level, I didn't have any scholarships, so I'm also having to work part-time while also going to school full-time. Mm. So it took up a lot of my time. I got burnt out in school and whatnot, and I just kind of wanted to get into something, you know, take a break from school, but maybe also entertain the idea of getting into something full-time, make some decent money so I can set myself up for...
Police officer just popped into your
mind?
Well,
not necessarily. One of the first things I actually wanted to do was... teach and coach sports, you know, football and baseball in particular. And
I think you'd be good at that.
Yeah, I had a passion for it, man. Football was my first love, baseball second. But I had an uncle that was in law enforcement. And he worked at a sheriff's office not far from where I grew up. And anyway, kind of picked his head about it. And long story short, you know, I kind of decided to get into it. And I actually sent myself to a police academy in Cleveland, Tennessee.
Hmm. Yeah, you're definitely the type of person, from what I've seen in the last year, kind of does for himself and goes out of your way to work on learning skills for whatever job you're in or want to be in on your own. You're real thirsty, I guess. How old are you?
I'll be 32 this year.
Damn, you're a kid. I'm only 36. Who the fuck am I talking about? But did you kind of grow up here in like not war stories, but cop war stories and cool shit from your uncle, and like from a young age it was like, wow, that's kind of cool? Or it was like, okay, now sports aren't working, I'm getting burned out? And was it like later in life?
It wasn't necessarily, you know, the run and gun and stories that, you know, that he told that kind of piqued my interest. You know, he was more of, you know, kind of explained to me that the importance that we need good people out here doing the job.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, some of those exciting stories that I told did kind of pique my interest, but it wasn't the entire picture. That's not why I decided to do it. But, you know, I just wanted to, you know, get into it and do the right things and, you know, be good at that particular job, because we need police officers out here. You know, we need people out here that are in the public eye that the people can trust. And I wanted to be that person.
Yeah, for sure. So where did you start off at? You go through the academy in Cleveland, and then I'm sorry about that, guys. I didn't hear him knocking. So you went through, you put yourself through. How long was the academy? Was it like at a college setting, or is it classroom, or is it like you guys are out at the range? I mean, how does that look?
So your legal studies portion is in a classroom setting, of course, You're on the range a couple of weeks out of the academy. There's EVOC and different things. So it was a lot of hands-on training as well. When I went through it 10 years ago, it was a 10-week course. Now at the local level, they've upped it to 12 weeks, and they're talking about extending it to 16 weeks or more.
Seems like the longer the better. But did you have to pay for that out of pocket, or was there some kind of financial aid you could do?
No, so I paid it out of pocket, and my boarding and everything. I worked part time at the city recreation department, and I just worked, saved money, decided that this is what I was going to do. I was going to pursue that career field. Saved up enough money to flip my own bill through the academy.
Nice.
Yeah.
So once you're done, you're looking for agencies that are hiring. Did you put in at one? You don't have to name names or towns or anything like that, but. Did you put in at one and you got the job? Did you do a bunch? How did that look?
Yeah, so there was a neighboring sheriff's office that was needing some post-certified officers. So in order for you to work as a law enforcement in Tennessee full-time, you have to have post-certification. So you get that post-certification at the completion of your academy. And so first gained employment at a neighboring sheriff's office in Warren County, Tennessee. I worked there for almost four years, and then ended up deciding to come back home and work for the city of Manchester.
Nice. Awesome. So how'd it feel when you got on the road? You're FTO, I'm assuming. Was that scary? Was it intimidating? Was it fun? A combination of all three?
Yeah, a little bit of all the above. So for me, in Warren County, I was not familiar with Warren County whatsoever. They stuck me on night shift with an FTO. It was an 8-week course, and I had to learn a whole new county, 438 square miles or so.
Damn.
Of county real estate. And, you know, I'm having to learn this whole place, back roads and all.
At night.
And if you go out there, no matter what part of the county you're in, you know, you look around, it's either a nursery field, a church, or a dollar store. So, I couldn't tell you where I was, you know, for the first 4 or 5 weeks, you know, of my training period.
That's one of my weaknesses is that would be hard for me. And yeah. I remember when I first moved down to Colorado, I worked at a ski mountain called Vail. Mm-hmm. I was a snowcat operator. So when people ski down, they cause these bumps to form called moguls, but they mm-hmm. pull snow down with them. Mm-hmm. So you can't have the whole mountain moguls. A lot of people don't like them. A lot of people can't ski them. So they have these big giant machines that probably have 10-foot wide track. No, they're not that wide, but maybe 6-8 foot wide tracks on each side with a 12-way blade and a tiller on the back, which spins. And then it drags this patterned, looks like corduroy pants. Mm-hmm. And you push the snow uphill and you till it and it leaves it flat and like corduroy behind you. And I didn't ski there a whole lot to begin with. I didn't really know the mountain. And we had to know it going uphill, reverse. Mm-hmm. None of the signs were facing downhill. Mm-hmm. And in the snow at nighttime, it was fucking hard. What were some other challenges that you faced as a new, you know, ride along FTO phase police officer?
You know, not having any background in law enforcement whatsoever. I tried to be a student. You know, I'm still trying. You know, a student of the laws, what you can and can't do, case law. You know, so that's always something that you should always try to stay up on. But as someone who had never had any law enforcement experience prior to that, all this, you know, legal jargon and verbiage and whatnot mm-hmm. tends to get a little overwhelming, not completely understanding what exactly you're reading and dealing with and how it applies to certain situations. But over time, you know, I was able to pick that up.
Nice. Yeah. What was your first kind of hair-raising event while you were in FTO, in the FTO phase, where you were like, oh, shit?
So I guess one of the things that kind of made me realize that, hey, this job is no joke, you know, you're dealing with life and death, was probably the first suicide call that I went on, you know. We had a suicide attempt call. You get there, and I ended up being one of the first ones on scene. You know, I'm 21 years of age. You know, this is my first hot call. And, I mean, it was a little bit overwhelming. You know, I'm the first car on scene, and this guy's, you know, shot himself. I mean, he's lifeless, you know, on the ground outside this home. And my wife is just coming out of the house, running, screaming, you know, wanting me to, you know, begging me to do something to help him. And it was just like, you know, there's nothing I could do.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the first real eye-opening experience that I had to deal with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Listening to my granddad's stories, some tough stuff you guys have to deal with. Mm-hmm. How'd it feel once you finally got out of your FTO phase and you got your own car?
Yeah. I mean, it felt like a little bit of freedom. You know, you felt like that, you know, you could actually go out here. I mean, I was still shadowed by some of my supervisors and my FTO still, but once I was out on my road, you know, you kind of felt like you can go out there and make your own decisions, which felt nice.
Nice.
You kind of be your own person, your own police officer, and make decisions for yourself and given situations.
Right. What was something that you found super funny when you were out working the road? Give us a funny story. I love hearing these.
So I'll tell you a story about there was one story back in my Warren County days at the sheriff's office there. So when I first started, there were some kind of some old heads that were old school police officers. You know, they were within a couple of years of retirement. So one of my supervisors, a lieutenant at that time, he was very, very old school. And the sheriff or my FTO said that, hey, you know, just because they're here, don't necessarily do things exactly the way that they do them. They're old heads and they do things their way. So we, in McMinnville, there's an event that is known as Back to the Strip. And it's an all-day affair, essentially, where people can bring out different hot rods and cars and whatnot, some really nice cars. And they basically they ride the main drag in town. And so it's a big event. There's people that come in from all over and ride these hot rods up and down the main roads there that run through McMinnville. And there's a plaza parking lot that runs right off of the main highway there, off Highway 56. And me and my FTO were just sitting there kind of watching traffic, monitoring everything, making sure everything was going the way that it's supposed to. And then we hear a truck spinning tires in this parking lot. So we look over. And sure enough, there's a bunch of kids out there, you know, doing donuts in the parking lot. And the parking lot's full, you know. They just have this little small area where they're doing the donuts at.
Recipe for disaster.
And so we rode over there. And shortly after we arrived, and we start talking to these kids. That old school supervisor of mine showed up and, you know, hey, Derek, what do we got going on? He's like, oh, these kids are just doing some donuts in the parking lot. You know, we're having to address it. And he's like, okay. So he walks over there himself and starts talking to these kids. He goes, boy, looks up at this kid that was doing the donuts. Hmm. He's like, boy, he said, you know, what would happen to your license status if this officer, you know, charged you with reckless driving? I don't know, sir. How long you been driving? No. And at that time, the kid was only driving like 2 or 3 months, you know, just got his license. He said, you know, state would probably pull your license. You wouldn't have a license anymore. What would your parents think if they knew you was out here, you know, doing these donuts in this parking lot? He's like, oh, man, you're not going to call my mom and dad, are you? Well, I thought about it, but what do you think we should do about this situation? Just ask the kid that. And he was just kind of like dumbfounded. What do you mean? You know, you know, how do we handle this situation? He's like, I tell you what, I'm not going to call any of your parents, but here's what I want you to do. If you don't get charged and you don't want your mom and dad to know about this, why don't you hop up in the bed of that truck? I want you to tuck your hands underneath your armpits, almost like you're, you know, flapping chicken wings. Uh-huh. And I want you to shout at the top of your lungs, I'm just a shit bird trying to fly. And he's like, are you serious? He's like, did I stutter, son? Get up in that truck and flap your arms like a chicken, and I want you to shout top of your lungs that you're a shit bird trying to fly. Sure enough, this kid hops up in the back of this truck, starts flapping his arms like he's a chicken. I'm just a shit bird trying to fly in front of his friends and everybody around, man. And my lieutenant's just gassing him up, you know. And he's like, son, I can't hear you. What are you? He said, I'm just a shit bird trying to fly. So I was like, oh my gosh, it was funny at the time. And we left, and my FTO was like, man, I looked at him. I was like, can we really do that? He's like, man, there's just some things that you don't do here, and there's other people that might be able to get away with it because they've been doing this a long time. So,
but, wow. Well, I mean, hell, he probably thought twice next time. You know, got super embarrassed.
He did, but you know, we ended up running into that kid a couple times thereafter. And, man, he gave us a lot of respect. He'd come up and shake our hands. We'd, you know, shoot the shit with him. We'd run into him from time to time. And he never gave us any grief for that, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, he thanked us for not calling his parents or charging him with reckless driving.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can only imagine. Yeah, yeah. I'd be shitting my pants in that situation if I was a 16-year-old kid.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the first big fight you got in?
We got a call of a... suspicious person at a convenience store, man. And the guy had been dropped off from, there's this Greyhound bus station that kind of come to one of our local convenience stores. It was a drop area where people can get on and off the Greyhound buses. Anyway, this one individual in particular had stayed at the convenience store for like 3 hours. So they call, you know, we've asked this person to leave. He's not doing any business, yada, yada. So anyway, I get there and, I walk inside the store and the clerks in the back are just pointing at this guy in the back, you know, not saying anything, which is kind of weird, you know. And I ended up asking one of the clerks, you know, hey, what's going on? And they point to the guy. They're like, hey, this guy's been in the back. He's not doing any business. We've asked him to leave, and he's refusing to leave. And so anyway, as he sees me walk in, of course, he's you know, walking by me to head out the door. And I said, hey, sir, come here and talk to me a second. And I asked him for some identification. As he's approaching to me, he starts to slip his hand in a pocket, and I notice that he's got something in his pocket. I can't tell what it is. Mm. Hey, brother, don't put your hand in your pocket. You know, you have any weapons on you? And he didn't say anything, just had this blank stare. So I'm thinking, this guy might be up to something. So anyway, I go to pat him down and make sure he doesn't have any weapons, and boy, the fight was on. And we tore that convenience store all to pieces.
Oh, no.
And so we get in the struggle. I'm, you know, trying to get this guy into custody. And at one point, he ends up grabbing the hood of my holster around my gun. Shoot, I mean, I did what I had to do. I don't want him on my gun. So I popped him a couple of times in the face, got him off of me. I was able to deploy a taser. At point blank range, I wasn't able to get in him, but at least it got him off of me. And I ended up getting into a foot chase and run him out the store. And
yeah,
took him into custody. He had a pocket knife in his right hip pocket, but it was kind of bizarre. I think he had a warrant in Davidson County or something. He didn't want to be, you know, hemmed up on, but you know, you never know what you're going to get into. But that, you know, I would say that was probably the first real fight that I've ever been in law enforcement.
What's another good one?
That's really the only fight I've ever been in. I mean, of course, you get into struggles with people. I wouldn't consider that a fight.
But, I got you. I got you.
But that, you know, real fight where fists are being thrown and stuff, that's probably the only where I've been in an actual fist fight with a guy.
Do you ever have any big dope finds before you started walking a dog?
Yeah, so, I don't have any stories of, you know, kilos off the interstate or anything like that.
But,
back in 2016 when I first started, my FTO, he had a real knack for going and hunting dope and really good at talking to people, communicating with folks, and getting consent in certain vehicles, and kind of picked his head about doing it. And so I ended up making a stop one night, started out just a speed infraction, and ended up getting a guy that was currently serving a state probation sentence, and got to talking about, you know, his criminal history and whatnot. And I noticed that he was just abnormally nervous. You know, this is a different type of nervous behavior that you...
if you want to fidget with it.
Oh, okay. But anyway, I just noticed, you know, some really abnormal behavior with this guy. So I ended up asking him for consent to search, and he ultimately ended up giving me consent to search the vehicle. And I ended up recovering some, like, 5 or 6 ounces of meth in the trunk of a car.
Wow.
Which, I mean, you know, in this day and time, you know, you're running into that more often. But in 2015, 2016, there was still a lot of shake and bakes going on. So when you're, you know, pulling out ounces of meth out of a car, that was considered a pretty large quantity.
And, yeah, especially in a small town and not on the interstate, you know.
Well, now, you know, these days, we're not running into meth labs anymore. Everything's imported. Everything's coming up from the southern border. So there's a lot more quantity of it, and there's a lot more of it out on the street these days, unfortunately.
What's the most amount of cash you ever seen on a criminal or in a seizure?
That I've been a part of?
Yeah. Yes or no.
It wasn't my case, but I've helped investigators on, you know, serving search warrants at different residences and whatnot. But I think the largest cash seizure that I've personally been a part of was around, between 50 and 60,000, I think. Damn. It was, yeah, in Warren County.
I've never seen that much money in person.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. I just want to point out that for the last 4 or 5 days, I've been watching Derek walk around with a pound of meth in a plastic tote. He's had it tucked under his arm like a football. He's just coming in to the training building, walking out, you know. Yeah, we're using it to train or work with drug dogs. But
yeah.
Did you know during your time in patrol that you wanted to go into canine, or how did that come up? Did you see somebody running a dog and you got interested?
From basic to advanced training, Joint Forces Canine offers Arkansas's best dog training services. Whether you want to get your pet up to speed on basic obedience or are looking for more advanced training such as specific odor detection, personal protection, competition and trial prep, service dog training, and more, the professionals at Joint Forces Canine will help your dog become the best that it can be. Joint Forces Canine is veteran-owned and offers all levels of training for pets and working dogs on their 20-acre dog training facility, which includes kennels, an indoor training arena, a pro shop, technical ponds, a trial field, and an agility course. Contact us today for more information and a free evaluation. You can also learn about our boarding, grooming, and working dog sales. Joint Forces Canine, www.jointforcescanine.com, or call 479-802-0775. jointforcescanine.com, 479-802-0775.
Yeah, so I grew up around dogs my whole life, you know. Growing up, I was around a lot of labs and Rottweilers and whatnot. And so when I got into law enforcement, one of my good friends in law enforcement ended up getting the opportunity to handle a dog. Now, his dog was single purpose, and I got to watch his dog work some. I used him on a couple of cases, and I thought, man, you know, and I'd always had this love for animals. And I thought, man, you know, that'd be a really good job, you know, a cool job if I could get an opportunity at doing that. And when I ended up working at Manchester, the opportunity presented itself. The chief at that time decided that we were going to add 2 dogs to the department, and I put in for it, interviewed for it, and ultimately got the job and started working with my partner now, Storm.
How did that first meeting go? How old was he when you first got placed with him?
With Storm?
Yeah.
I think he was between 18 months, 20 months, between 18 and 20 months.
Nice. So. Did you guys have any issues initially? Was he pretty easy to you know, get along with? Or?
Oh, no. Initially, he was an asshole.
Was he?
Oh, my God. He was, so he was imported from Holland. We picked him up in Nashville. And so as soon as he landed in the States, I brought him home. Mm-hmm. And the department had already set up a kennel, you know, at my place in the backyard in the fenced-in area. And so we get him in the kennel. You know, he's kind of, you know, stressed and shocked and whatnot. He really wasn't all that bad at first. But after he kind of settled down in that kennel and I went out that night to feed him for the first time, he was ready to eat my ass up. I couldn't open the door to feed him or nothing. So what did I do? I had this bowl of food in my hand. He's acting an ass. He's just wanting to tear my ass up. I just turn around and walk in the house.
Mm.
That's it.
Yep.
And so the next morning, I'm going to try this again. And I went out to feed him the next morning. Same behavior. Acted a complete fool, wanting to tear me up. Walked right back in the house. Did that evening, the next day, the next morning. But the evening, thereafter, so this is what, 2-3 days in, I went out there that last day, that evening, to feed him. Behavior stopped.
Nice.
He was ready to eat.
Yeah.
The behavior that he was exhibiting before wasn't working for him. He chilled out, opened the door, set the bowl of food down. He started eating. I started rubbing on the back of his ears. We were bros ever since.
Nice. So he didn't like resource guard or have any issues once you put it in front of him?
No.
Nice.
No.
And I just want to point out, dogs can go a very long time without food. So don't let me get your fucking panties in a bunch. Hunger is a very powerful motivator. And for those of y'all pet dog owners, there's some strong ass dogs and you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. No, he was for real.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he still is. I've worked him several times. How did he start? I mean, so you get him, do you have to go through like a handler's course? Did he have to go on through any more training? Was he trained when you got him?
So he was, I guess what you would consider a green dog. He had a little bite work foundation on him, but all the tracking and the narcotics detection, the obedience we started in handler school. And, we didn't really start, we finished handler school, we got certified, but it really wasn't until I started attending this seminar in Kentucky, On Point Canine Seminar, and getting around a lot of good folks, where that's when we really started to get better and excel.
Nice. Yeah, from last year to now, I could see a big difference in you guys. A lot of the dogs here, even, Gil, hopefully he comes on, he's been doing a lot better. Not that you guys weren't doing good before, but just seeing improvement, shows that it works. Has he ever come up to leash on you?
A few times in training.
Yeah,
a lot of frustration. Yeah. I mean, and at the time, it was the first real dog that you ever handled. You don't really realize, how to communicate with your dog. Obviously they don't speak English, right? Mm-hmm. So you're having to learn a little bit of psychology with it. And if you don't understand, the basics of operant conditioning, and you could be unfair to the dog and not even realize it. And if you're dealing with a high strung dog, he's going to let you know when you're unfair. So there's a few instances where he's come up on me, but nothing out of maliciousness, he let me know a time or two that, hey, cut this out. I'm ready for my reward or my treat or whatever.
Right. Right. When you guys got together, were there any doubts? Okay. Is this dog really going to have my back? And if so, when did that kind of solidify? Okay. We're partners. We're a team. This is it.
Yeah. Before my first physical apprehension, I always wondered, is my dog really going to bite somebody for real? Cause in training, a lot of times there's equipment involved, and I don't know many folks out here that are willing to take a live bite, And so, it wasn't until, I guess, we worked an aggravated assault case and ended up tracking somebody. And he ended up locating the subject underneath a large brush pile on this track. And, man, he went in right away and nabbed this guy. And we ended up pulling this guy out of this brush pile. I knew right then that, hey, this dog has he's going to have my back. Like, I know now that he's capable of apprehending somebody for real. It's not equipment fixation anymore.
Yeah.
So it made me feel a little bit better.
How many live bites does he have? Street bites?
He's had three.
Three?
Yeah, three.
Why don't you walk us through one or two of those?
So
that other was than that one.
Yeah. So that was the first one. We were probably 4 or 5 months in certified on the road, I think it was. And then we didn't get our next one until almost a couple years after that. And kind of how this call came about, we got a call of a suicidal subject in a home armed with a handgun. And so I'm one of the first ones that arrive on scene. And when I get there, this guy's girlfriend is, you know, running to my patrol car as I'm pulling up, screaming, telling me that her boyfriend's inside with a gun. And she, you know, I'm asking for his name. She tells me who he is and what kind of background he's got. He was prior military. She explains that he's got severe PTSD. Another officer arrives, you know, a couple minutes thereafter. So we go inside initially and we try to negotiate with him. Hey, buddy, come outside. We're here to help you. All those things. And the guy's just inside screaming at the top of his lungs. And she proceeds to tell us that before she called, you know, he had that gun up underneath his chin, you know, and she felt that he was going to take his life, you know, in the near future, like, you know, within that time frame. So I had her, you know, remain outside, but kind of go around to the side where her vehicles were parked and kind of, you know, stand behind those vehicles because we didn't know what to expect, you know, here coming thereafter. And so me and the other officer that arrived on scene, we start calling the guy out from the living room. He's in a far back bedroom down a hallway. And we're calling this guy out by name, and he just continues to scream at us. You know, not really saying anything in particular, just screaming. And after about 7-8 minutes or so of trying to, you know, get this guy called out, he stops screaming. He gets silent. Now we're thinking, what's going on in there? And a few minutes of that silence passes by, and then we hear a third voice calling this guy by name and telling him, you know, they're saying, hey, stop it, man, quit. Now we know there's a third party involved, and we heard what sounded like a struggle going on in the room. You know, there was no mention of this third party being involved.
That's crazy.
And so me and that other officer, we decide to go right now and proceed down that hallway. We hook right into the room. Well, there was a buddy of his that was in there trying to help prevent him from hurting himself. So as we hook right into the room, his buddy ends up kicking a handgun away from him. And there's this struggle on the ground with the guy. And so this guy, I don't know if there was any like hard drug or substance abuse, but he was severely intoxicated. He was going into a very, very manic PTSD episode. When we entered the room, you know, he's a prior Afghan war veteran. He was calling us Taliban. In his view, he was in a fight for his life. So we were trying, you know, we were struggling to get him into custody. And so a couple more officers arrive on scene. At this point, you know, we were on the ground struggling with him for 3-4 minutes, you know, 3-4 minutes wrestling with a guy is exhausting. And so, when we got another officer there, to us, trying to get control of the guy. And of course his buddy didn't want to see any harm done to him, but he's not letting go of him either. So, not only are we trying to get him into custody, but his buddy is kind of hindering us from doing that. So you got the gun that's initially that was kicked loose. Well, you look in the room, there's long guns laying on the wall too. We can't let him to get to any of those. And so I made the decision at that moment to deploy the dog. And so
how'd you do that?
With a door pop. Yeah. So how, when I pulled up, you know, I pulled up right in front of the front door, which I'd always try to socialize Storm with anybody I work with on a shift. And so he had a good relationship, you know, with everybody that I worked with. And so I told the next officer that arrived on scene, I said, hey, hold that front door open. I'm about to pop this door, start calling for him into the house. And so sure enough, hit the button. We're all calling for him. He comes inside, and the guy's still fighting with us. He's not stopping. And so I ended up straddling him up and placing him on a leg, and we got immediate compliance then. We were able to get him into custody, out the dog. It was over with. Tragic situation, but, you know,
he didn't kill himself. He didn't kill himself. Anybody else.
And, you know, if we had let that go on any longer, who knows what could happen, you know, would it have escalated into a deadly force situation? I don't know, but we damn sure don't want that to happen.
Yeah. I'd rather a dog bite than get shot.
Yeah. So, I mean, arguably that dog bite saved his life.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about the third and final one before we move on?
So, My last one ended up getting a guy that had some felony drug sales warrants. He had fled in a vehicle and got away from a couple of different agencies around us. Ended up getting him as a passenger on a traffic stop, and he bolts, he bails as soon as the car comes to a stop. And this individual in particular, so NCIC is the National Crime Database. So it, you know, gives us all the information we need in terms of stolen vehicles, wanted persons, yada, yada. So this person in particular was a flag NCIC violent offender. And we knew that going into it. And so anyway, I stopped the vehicle, figure out, hey, this is the guy that's run from a couple of different places. He bolts, and I end up door popping storm and sent him, and he was able to get him.
Yeah. Where'd you get him? Legs, arms?
Leg.
Yeah.
Leg.
Guy gave up right away?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, immediate compliance. So it was just me and the dog. I had another officer that was also on the stop with me. He remained with the vehicle. It was just me and the dog. And he took him down. I was able to get control of the suspect, put him in cuffs, out of the dog. It was done.
What are some challenges that normal people might not realize that you guys face when it comes to being police officers with a dog as a partner?
I don't think a lot of people understand all the work that it takes to get to, especially with a dual purpose dog, and what all the work it entails. And I think some people generalize all dogs the same. You know, I've had people that want me to track, you know, missing kids and whatnot with a storm. I'm not going to track a missing kid. You know, if he finds them before I do, he'll bite passive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tell them that, you know, I'm not willing to track and try to find this kid of theirs, you know, they get mad. And of course, well, why do we have this dog if you're not going to use him? And so, I mean, it's hard to get people to understand and explain that, hey, just because we have a dog, his job is not this. You know, this is a certain kind of dog for a, you know, particular job, and this is not one of his jobs. I'm not going to run the risk of, you know, mangling up a kid and having all these disfigurements that remain with him the rest of his life. Right. You know, that's crazy, you know. So it's hard to get people to understand exactly what these dogs are and what they're designed to do in terms of their job.
What about, like, financially? And so we, you know, time that, like, costs, gear, food, after hours, stuff like that.
Yeah, so, you know, we don't have a lot of department funding in terms of getting equipment for the dog and different training and whatnot. So
that's kind of nationwide, too.
It is, you know, and it's, you know, canines, when it comes to budget cuts, unfortunately, canines is one of the first thing that gets cut out of the budget. A lot of the equipment that Storm has, I've furnished myself.
Mm.
We've had some things, you know, donated to us and whatnot, but a lot of it's my own.
Yeah.
And it's a battle trying to convince even your upper management, you know, why you need certain piece of equipment and why some of this training is necessary. And they don't understand it because they've never done it themselves.
Right.
You know, so that's a battle that everybody's facing just about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just you guys specifically or anything, but, how many, let me think here. Have you guys ever not found somebody on a track that, you know, somebody had bailed out and you just never found the guy? Or has he been pretty successful?
I mean, there's been instances where we don't track and, you know, where we track and not find people, and there's, you know, who knows what the variables are. I mean, you know, maybe they got in a vehicle and got away. You know, there's been
all kinds of stuff out
there. Yeah, man, tracking is one of the hardest things that you'll do, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, you can't control the scenario. If you don't have a good perimeter set up, you know, almost right away, mm-hmm. your chances of success are greatly diminished. But in the instances where we do have a pretty decent perimeter set up, our success rate has been far greater.
Nice.
So a lot of our tracking scenarios have kind of been dependent a lot of times on whether or not we have a decent perimeter or not.
Aside from his first street bite, what's your proudest memory so far of working with your current partner?
Probably one of his drug busts. So, you know, obviously in this country we have a big fentanyl epidemic. You know, there's a lot of folks that are dying due to drug overdoses, and in large part because of fentanyl. You know, there's fentanyl in a lot of these pressed pills and It's even been, I've even seen it cut in marijuana. I mean, I've worked some overdoses where people have smoked some marijuana, not realizing that substance is contaminated with fentanyl. So, I mean, fentanyl's a big problem. And you know, we're talking about salt grains of fentanyl that are taking people out. And so we ended up having a pretty significant drug bust on a traffic stop. And, is, you know, not the biggest seizure in the world, but it's our biggest seizure in terms of the drug amount. We, this traffic stop consists of about a pound of methamphetamine, a little bit more, a couple pounds of marijuana, a few ounces of cocaine, but there was a sack of fentanyl that was, I don't know, 4 or 5 ounces worth. So if you're talking about salt grains worth of fentanyl taking somebody out, how much, I mean, just imagine what 4 or 5 ounces of fentanyl could do. I mean, how many people could it potentially take out? So when you look at it from that perspective, you know, long, you know, it, had we not have intercepted that, you know, how many people could that stuff have taken out? And you got to think, you know, did this drug bust, did Storm, by using Storm and locating this in a vehicle, did he, is there the potential that he saved somebody's life down the road? Maybe. You know, so I was pretty proud to.
And he's not, most dogs, most dual purpose dogs are not imprinted on fentanyl. That just happened to go along with what he actually was, because there's a legality thing there, because people can have a legal source of fentanyl prescription wise, correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's people walking around with fentanyl patches.
Yeah. And you know, so sorry to step on you, but that kind of leads me into my next point. Like, I feel like with you being a handler and running a dog, that case law is a lot more pronounced, or a bigger part or role of the canine job. Is would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What are some, you know, examples or struggles pertaining to case law that you kind of had to overcome or learn, or
which I always try to be a student of case law anyway, but you know, a lot of the things, a couple of case law pieces that come to my mind for that handlers should probably know is, of course, Graham v. Conner, especially if you're handling a dual purpose dog. You know, that's the 3-part test of reasonableness. I think handlers should know that case law, you know, almost to a T. And then when it comes to narcotics detection, you know, you've got Rodriguez versus U.S. and Illinois versus Caballos. You can't just unnecessarily prolong a stop for the sole purpose of using a dog. So, I mean, if you've got some, you know, an officer that's got somebody stopped on a traffic stop, and it's absent any reasonable suspicion of additional criminal activity going on beyond the initial reason for the traffic stop altogether, you can't just hold them there for the purpose of using a dog. But if there are articulable facts, you know, based on your training and experience as an officer, that would lead him to believe that, hey, there's something in addition to this.
Well, what would be an example of that?
You know, like if they're, you know, for, you know, the easiest scenario that comes to my mind, you know, are they leaving a known drug location? You get to interviewing them, they're lying about where they're coming from and where they're going and those sorts of things. You know, that might be enough to keep them there to utilize a dog in that scenario.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What are some challenges that you have personally faced being on the road with Canine Storm? Other than, you know, some of the tiffs that you guys had initially.
I don't know.
That's kind of a weird question. Yeah.
I'm sure that, I mean, there's just not one that comes to mind immediately. I mean, of course we all run into challenges, you know, working dogs and whatnot. One thing that's always a challenge is he's a stubborn dog. So, you know, when we're getting ready for certification, the outing is always a big topic of discussion when we're preparing for.
But he does it.
He does it. Yeah.
So yeah, it's.
But he's also a hard dog, and he's stubborn. He really wants that bite too when you present him with the right situation.
Yeah. No, he's looking good. He's been looking real good today. One of the scenarios we did yesterday was a bad guy who had fled into a house and was hiding between some studs underneath a tarp in the stairwell. And I think your dog was one of the fastest that came in and went right to it, even bit right through the tarp and, you know, got the bad guy, saving, you know, potentially your ass and your partner's ass. Mm-hmm. And well, let me move on from that. So I noticed you got a bite suit and you're kind of, you know, stepping aside from just wanting to be the handler. How are you liking wearing the suit and starting to kind of learn the ropes there?
Alrighty, and our last podcast sponsor is Pocket Suite. So I've been using Pocket Suite personally for 2 to 3 years now, and it's an app that was developed specifically for dog trainers and their business. So I do all of my scheduling, I do my deposits, I do my waiver, my credit card authorization, all of the paperwork that I send to new clients. You add all of your clients in there, you can sell packages, you can do your lessons, and it ties in with your Google Calendar or whatever calendar that you use on your phone. But you can also tie it into your website. You can have links so that people can schedule directly through your website. You know, you program your schedule so that you're open during this time and you're not during this time. There's so many different features that it would be impossible to list them all. It has powerful marketing tools like leads and reviews, proven to help you build a lot of four or five star reviews online. And then that also translates into incoming leads. You can use my unique referral link. I'm going to put that in the show notes to sign up and get $50 off of a year's worth of Pocket Suite. You could also do pet profiles. So every dog in the same family, you have its own notes, pictures, history. It's just a really good app that you can run your entire canine dog business out of. It's awesome. So highly recommend it. It's called Pocket Suite. Check them out. Use my unique referral code. I'm going to post that in the show notes. So anyways, enjoy the episode, guys. Thank you.
So, you know, it sounds crazy to most people, but I just enjoy working dogs and seeing the progression. You know, I haven't found much, you know, as much joy, you know, in something until I started working dogs. You know, all my joy in life, you know, growing up, you know, I was heavily involved in sports and whatnot. So I had a lot of joy doing those things, and it wasn't until I started working dogs where I found similar joy. And so I'm fascinated with behavior and seeing the potential in what these dogs have to offer. And so not only am I just, you know, I never wanted to be content in just having a leash in my hand. I wanted to, you know, not just be a handler, but I want to get into the training aspect of it too. You know, if you can, you know, if you're a student of the craft and can get better at training, it's just going to make you a better handler on the road too.
Right. Do you have any aspirations to be a trainer, whether that's pet dogs or and working dogs and or both?
Yeah, I don't know. I think my short-term goal is I want our department to have a reliable unit. I want to see it grow and maybe, you know, train the unit and be over that unit one day. But in the short term, I just like to see, you know, a department in our area that, hey, you know, if you call for one of these dogs, you're getting the real deal. You know, this is no joke. You're going to get a reliable dog in any aspect of it. You know, whether it's narcotics detection or apprehension work, tracking. You know, I want some real dogs that are going to be reliable that the community can count on.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's what we all want, to be the best versions of ourselves or whatever, you know, our chosen path is. But how old is Storm now?
He just turned six. He turned six in January 15th.
You're hoping to get another 2-3 years out of them?
I'd like to, yeah. You know, 3 years would be great. I know 2 years is probably, you know, around about where it ends. But if all goes well and he stays in good health, you know, I'd like to retire him on his ninth birthday, which will be a Friday.
How is he to live with?
Well, he's great. He's got a great on and off switch. You know, it didn't all start out that way in the beginning, but I just spent a lot of time with the dog and I socialized him, you know, with just the folks that I work with. You know, on the job, but over time, he just kind of developed this on off switch. He and I have a good bond. We have a good relationship. And even at home, I mean, there's times I can just cut him loose, you know, around the house. And a lot of people would cringe at that idea. Mm. And I'm not saying that you should do that with every dog, but, right. In his case, he's got a great on off switch. It's like when he sees me putting on the uniform, a whole nother gear click, you know, starts turning,
right.
Take the gear off. He knows that, hey, we're going home and it's time to chill out and relax. So it's nice.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we'll start kind of winding down here, a little bit shorter than I normally go, but we got obligations, folks. What would you say to the next generation that's coming up that wants to get into law enforcement?
Always study, keep your nose in a book in terms of the law. Always be up to date on case law. You know, that's the backbone of what we can and can't do. It dictates what we can and can't do. But just be yourself. You know, don't, you know, treat people with respect. Not everybody's a criminal. Sometimes people make mistakes in life. Doesn't mean that they're a bad person. And in a large part, I think if you treat people with respect, 9 times out of 10, you'll get it back. You know, so I think that would be my advice to somebody new that's entertaining the idea of getting into law enforcement.
What would you say to the civilian that's out there that may kind of be seeing all this shit on TV and CNN or whatever, and they kind of have a negative outlook towards our members of law enforcement?
Yeah, a lot of the videos that you see, people tend to want to have court on the side of the shoulder of the road, you know, and my advice would be that's not the time and place to do it. You know, we do have a right to due process. Let that process play out. If you don't agree with the decisions that officer's made, you know, you have that right to due process. Well, you know, I would say, you know, share your argument in a courtroom setting. And that's, right. That's the way the system's designed. We're not going to have it on the side of the road. You know, if an officer asks you to step out of the vehicle, you're going to need to get out of the vehicle. You know? There's case law that says that you have to. You
right.
know? So
for any reason.
Yeah, let's not have court on the side of the road. You don't have to agree with our decisions. And if there's an argument to be made, you have the right to a defense. So that would be my suggestion to any civilian.
And, hey, you know, job application is always there.
Yeah.
Put the boots on, put the belt on, go to work, get promoted and change it if you got a problem.
Yeah, I've even brought that up to some that are very, very critical of what we do. And I've told them, well, hey, we've got some positions opening. If you think you can make a difference, come on and apply and come work with us. We'd love to have you.
You know, that's awesome. Yes,
sir. They oftentimes don't take us up on that offer.
Oh yeah. I could imagine. I could absolutely imagine. A lot of keyboard warriors out there. Mm-hmm. One final question for you. What, and we'll kind of, you know, we're ping ponging here, but, what was the most what was the scariest situation that you've personally been in law enforcement?
So, this, again, happened when I first started out with the sheriff's office. We get a call of, subject that was, so it was a subdivision setting, essentially. There was a small narrow road so you basically got two intersecting highways, in Warren County. And there's a small road that kind of runs in between those two intersecting highways. So it's a one lane road. And there's a subdivision that runs off of it. Well, we got a call that came in and there was a subject that was said, be taking items to and from his house into, you know, from a vehicle or from the house into the vehicle. And they weren't familiar with who the subject was. And, so anyway, me and my sergeant responded to the call. I'm coming from one end of that one lane road. He's coming from the other. He arrives on the scene first. Was he's about to pull up on scene. That, subject had seen my sergeant pulling up and what this guy was doing, he was stealing from this home. Mm. And so he sees the sergeant, you know, coming down the road, and he hops in this car, throws it in drive, and hightails it out of there. So now we've got this pursuit going on. Ends up on this one-lane road, and it's a very windy road. There's hills on each side of the roadway. I'm coming up the other end. My sergeant's calling out a pursuit now. And as soon as the words essentially pursuit come out, this car comes around a curve. I'm on the other end. I never see this guy coming. He's doing about 70. Mm. And I'm just, you know, I was probably doing 30, 35 mile an hour. He hits me head on.
Mm.
I was in a brand new car too. First brand new car I've ever had in my career. Smashes the front end of my car, airbags deploy, hit my head up on the A pillar of the car. And anyway, I see the guy jump out and bail. And so I get out of the car as well, and I'm in a foot chase with him, telling him to stop. He's running uphill to this wood line. And once he gets to the wood line, he stops and he proceeds to turn. As he's turning towards me, his hand is going into his waistband.
Mm.
At this point, I've got my gun drawn. I'm thinking, this is it. He's got a gun in his waistband. And, man, that was the closest I've ever come to shooting somebody.
Mm.
Fingers on the trigger. I see his hand going for his waistband. I hear this pop. A sergeant I didn't realize was just behind him and was in pursuit of him too, you know, on foot. He had tased him.
Oh, wow.
I mean, within milliseconds of me pulling the trigger,
mm.
you know, so it was a pretty, pretty scary situation. And you know what the crazy thing about that situation was?
Hmm.
It wasn't a gun that he had in his waistband. It was a freaking butane torch lighter that he intended to point at me.
Oh, wow.
To make me think that it was a firearm. And I could have shot him over it, you know?
Wow.
To think about it. And so long story short, you know, this guy had a bunch of felony warrants. The vehicle was stolen. He was stealing from a house. There's a a significant amount of meth in the car. There's a stolen firearm in the car, some other stolen property. And of course he was high as a giraffe's ass on meth, didn't know what the heck he was doing. But yeah. Yeah.
Well, I get it, man. We all want to go home to our families. Yeah, no doubt. So, well, thank you, dude. Thanks for taking the time to do this. We've been talking about it for a while, and I'm glad we did it face-to-face and not through a computer. So,
yeah. Thanks for having me.
Of course, brother. All right, man. Well, let's go get some food.
See you.
Thank you for listening to the Dogs of War.